So it's quite intimidating to be asked to give a keynote speech. And I think maybe it ranks only below being asked to give a graduation speech in terms of its interim effect. And I asked Warren what I should talk about, and the conversation kind of wandered back and forth between healthcare policy, the future of healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. I'm extremely capable of doing that. I could go on for hours. It would be really interesting. Then we wandered over to, we'll just talk about your career, because you've touched a lot of different things, and I could go on and on for hours about that. It would be extremely interesting. But so I've been banging from pillar to post with respect to this topic, and I've decided to see if I could talk about my career, but use it maybe to frame a little bit what's been going on in healthcare, at least during my my life. I started out being interested in public policy in school. In college, I was a political science major. I got interested in urban studies, which was kind of a good topic in those days. When I got here, I found myself, I won't pick on anybody because it's not worth, but the administrative law course I had, which was this kind of natural entree into thinking about the intersection of government activity and private activity, was really boring. And so I began to think, maybe that's not the intersection I want, and I started wandering into some other areas. But I did end up taking communications law. I took a lot of tax stuff. And the issues that animated me continue to be this intersection between government as a regulator, government as a payer, and the world of people being regulated or being paid. And I came ultimately under, you know, the very beneficial and guidance and into the domain of Dick Merrill, who, among his other skills, was wonderfully able to make me interested in food and drug law as an undergrad. I ended up working with him as a student assistant. And so when I got done school and I got done the clerkship, I followed what was, for my class, a well-worn path to his alma mater, which was Covington and Burling. Five of us from my class went up there. And it's no question that that's why. It was sort of a direct path from Dick Merrill's office, as best I can tell. And two of them are still there, including Dick Kingham, who is my good friend and classmate of Johnny Jeffries and I, and probably the world's greatest FDA lawyer today, a proud product of Dick Merrill and his mentor, Peter Hutt, and others. So I found myself, therefore, at Covington, interested in food and drug law, and I was promptly put on an antitrust case involving regulation of barge line pricing. And I'll never forget, in my first year, being sent to Cincinnati, brutal summer, document searching in a warehouse. And that the most brutal stretch was 10 days straight. The Cincinnati baseball team was not at home. It was just horrifying. I did get some exposure to food and drug law. I worked for one particular partner from time to time. Among his topics was the many challenges of the Cosmetics, Toiletries, Fragrances Association, which was always in an uproar about some problem with red dye number 5 or some goddamn thing, and it was just intensely boring. It was just above using micrometers to measure trademarks, and it was all I could do to run out of there. So the escape hatch for me was to go to the sponsored pro bono thing that Covington did at the Neighborhood Legal Services Program. It was not health specifically, but I ended up there with an enormous amount of interaction with people on welfare and who were having trouble maintaining their benefits, whether they were for pure aid to families with dependent children or Medicaid, who were having trouble with their landlords. And so when I came back to Covington after my few month tenure, I asked whether I could get into the domain of Chuck Miller, who had as a clientele states who were suing the federal government in general because the federal government was not living up to its financial responsibilities in various, by and large, welfare and other kinds of entitlement programs. He had nothing, but I kept after him. And at one point, the state of New York came and hired Covington, and finally there was a job. And the task was to defend the state in the first sort of important cost containment litigation brought by the hospitals against the state as the Medicaid payer for cutting their rates and putting them on a so-called prospective payment system. This was in the mid-70s. New York was going broke. New York City almost went into bankruptcy. Some of the older folks here will remember that. It was a brutal time. We're actually, in some ways, moving towards that again, if you look at the financial condition of many municipalities. But it was serious, and so the state had to save money, and they decided they had to save money in Medicaid. There was, you know, all the same conversations that are going on now about healthcare as a percentage of GNP, et cetera, were going on, and the state stepped up and changed the way it paid hospitals in order to do that. So from that day till this, I never looked back. I loved what I saw. I got interested in medicine. Who knew? I never knew anything about medicine. I got interested in science in ways that have made me, as my daughter would say, kind of a science groupie. I thought the ethics were interesting, the economics were interesting, the law was interesting. Plus, most of the time you're reading about something on the front page that that involved the field. So I never looked back, and that's all I've done since. And of course, it's a huge business. So I've been able to find employment in lots of different ways. It's an interesting business. In some ways, it really is an American cultural dilemma. Right. So I'm from Boston, and every day I see dozens of license plates from New Hampshire that say, live free or die. And we're being exposed to a lot of that right now in the Republican primaries, I guess. The thing that the FDA gets beat up the most about is because if it under-regulates a product, the thing hospitals get beat up about the most and where they get regulated to most actually is around quality and poor care, malpractice, et cetera. So there's a vast taste and thirst for regulation not of healthcare, notwithstanding live free or die. There's also, I think, an odd kind of interesting tolerance which happens in education, but really happens in healthcare, of course, which is we really trust the not-for-profits. And we're a little uncertain about people who have profit motives. You know, is that for-profit hospital really going to take as good care of me as the University of Virginia? And it's an interesting thing. I mean, we have a duality in our culture. We like business, we like private activity, but you know, if I'm really sick, I may just want to go to the nonprofit academic center in my neighborhood. And we let the government own a lot of hospitals, and we let them employ a lot of doctors. And you know, that's evolved over the years. But every day you see this dilemma of ethics, of politics, of emotion, in which people at one time, you know, is healthcare a right? Is it a privilege? You know, should poor people have insurance? Blah blah blah. It's not live free or die, and so I found it fascinating. I found it fascinating. In terms of law students, of whom I assume most of you are, it's a great field. You want to do M&A, securities law, corporate law, go for it. Labor law, fascinating. Criminal law, got a lot of that. You like entrepreneurs, you want to work with entrepreneurs, you want to be an entrepreneur, you want to be an investment banker, you want to be a venture capitalist, couldn't be a better feel. And it's much more interesting at some ultimate level of how you feel about it when you get home than banking, just to choose one, in my personal opinion. That said, I found myself really liking the New York client. I got to know the governor's people. I got to know the health department people. I just enjoyed being around them. It was intense. I mean, it was a huge deal. This was a big lawsuit. It was big money. It was whether New York City and state would survive, at least to some extent, wrapped up in it. And in the sort of mystic way of things, I was offered a job by the state for which I was completely unqualified, which was to come up and join the regulatory agency they were crafting to sort of meet, you know, sort of evolve their own regulatory apparatus to meet the new way of payment and regulation that they wanted to put in place. So these were early days of health planning, of, as I say, prospective payment, of regulating unseemly nursing homes, and of attempting to crack down on fraud and abuse. All of this sort of presaging themes that have gone on for years. So I took the job, I went up, and I became the number two guy in this regulatory department. I was now a manager. I knew nothing about being a manager. I knew virtually nothing about politics. And indeed, when I got there, I remember thinking quite disdainfully for a while, how many of these judgments were not analytically, empirically, whatever, pure? They were political judgments. And it was kind of, you know, I felt odd about it. I'd gone to a good high school, I'd gone to a good college, I'd gone to a good law school, I'd had a good clerkship, a good law firm. And, you know, the premium was on really crystalline, clear thought, rigorous analysis, and reasonable people disagree, a better judgment comes out of the argument, yada, yada. And this was, well, that's all fine, but, you know, we promised the Archbishop that we were going to take care of this for him. Or you can't put poor Sister Marie Michelle Peartree out of business because she's got a, you know, she's a lovely nun, and her nursing home in Rochester may be out of compliance with the fire codes, but, you know, she's a lovely person. So I started getting introduced to that. And I also was surrounded by people who, by the measure of everybody in this room, were not as smart, I suppose. At some level, maybe mediocre. But you know what? I came to really like it. I mean, the people were there for a reason. They wanted to help, in this case, Medicaid beneficiaries. They wanted hospitals to run well. They wanted things to be better. And they were great people. And they were really capable in so many ways. They're bureaucrats. Some of them were great bureaucrats. Some were bureaucrats. But in general, it was a wonderful environment. And I loved that tribe. It was the first time I'd been in a tribe that wasn't the tribe that's in the room. And it was fantastic, eye-opening. And it was wonderful to help me, at least, understand why political judgments are often the best judgments, notwithstanding their analytic impurity. So I did that in New York. I went down, got more or less the same job at what was then HICVA and HHS, now is CMS. Bigger levers to pull and sort of more overarching policies that you could influence. Not as much fun. I was never offered a bribe at HICVA, but I was offered a bribe in New York, which was great. You know, I remember sitting with a guy one time, the for-profit nursing home was in there, and we're talking about some labor thing. This is a guy from out of Long Island, great big guy, gold pinky ring, you know, the whole thing. He says, unions? Don't worry about the unions. We don't have no problem with the unions. Okay, sorry. You know, it was great. Not so, a little more abstract, a little more academic in Washington. But you know what? Same thing. People really motivated. People who wanted to be there, who had chosen, who had gone to public policy school or, had chosen a career in public life and in public finance and in public benefits because they wanted to help. So I really, you know, that was fantastic for me. So, as a political appointee, Ronald Reagan gets elected. Goodbye to me, which was fine. I agreed to stay through the transition, and I arrived at Hogan and Hartson on the morning of Ronald Reagan's inauguration, and went back to practicing. But now I had become a little bit of an entrepreneur myself. I didn't want to represent states, so, and I wanted to build a business. And Hogan was enthusiastic about that. Kind of a, they had built a lot of defined practices, and they thought a health, regulatory, and reimbursement practice might make some sense. So I was delighted. I knew about payments to hospital. I knew about hospital regulation. That was about it. But happily, I also knew about New York. So a lot of my initial clients were people from New York, and they were almost invariably academic centers who were reeling under the changing environment in which they sat. Medicare had put the DRG prospective payment system in place by then, and a lot of these hospitals just didn't know what hit them, and they were having to become better managed. They were having to think about merging with other hospitals. They were having to reform their relationship with their doctors and with the medical colleges and schools that were on, often on the same campus. So I had a long, happy run with that as part of my practice. My best client, my most interesting client was Cornell University, which had a medical school in New York, which was on the same campus with the New York Hospital, which is a very proud, old, aristocratic, Upper East Side institution. And regarded Cornell as sort of a country cousin that provided some service in the way of educating doctors for them. In the end, I helped reform sort of that relationship. Deans came and went. The curriculum was rethought, somehow I got involved in that. Tech transfer was starting to be a big issue. How can you get financial reward as the university out of the ideas from your scientists and physicians? Faculty practice, how can we make a little bit more money? How can we get our physicians to make a little bit more money, be more guys, and get a little more benefit from it as an institution? At one point, New York Hospital acknowledged that they had 180,000 visits a year to the outpatient department, which they always called the hard bench clinic because they were essentially long-time charity, and they didn't bill for any of them. It was just charity, right? So this is a world in which now they're reeling with losses. They're trying to be more managerial. That's the 180,000 visits a year that they couldn't even account for. They knew they had them. They could count the 180. So it was great. It was wonderful. The other thing that happened to me in those days was if you reach me as a Washington lawyer, generally your inside lawyer, your local general counsel, your local specialty counsel, and the longtime specialty counsel that you'd always used in health stuff weren't up to the task. So I was like the fourth or fifth triage for a lot of stuff. And so what it meant was my practice in general that was not the academic side was new stuff, new services, new products. It was kind of a beautiful thing. Because the typical problem was we have something new and we can't get paid for it. Or we have something new and they won't pay us enough for it. Can you help? So that would mean usually it was the most critical issue for the company, which meant I got to work with the senior people and think about their strategy. So my first client in that regard was a guy named Jim Sweeney, who had grown up in San Diego, carried a bag selling parenteral products, infusion products for Baxter American. And Sweeney was very knowledgeable, as those companies were, about what had become a pretty new technology through. It was amino acids solutions, which you could then infuse into people who had no bowel function and keep them alive in very normal ways for a very long time. And in the cases of the people most needy, they would come to the hospital every day or every other day and get 6-8 hours of infusion, just sitting in the chair, spending a night. So Sweeney figured out you could get those patients home if they learned how to take care of themselves and you had proper nursing, especially nursing, especially pharma, delivery, et cetera, capabilities. And he set a little business up around it, working with the Cleveland Clinic, and then with other academic centers. And it was terrific. It was just what you want. It was a newly envisioned way of taking care of people, a new institution, if you will, emerging from the, you know, the consequences of amino acid technology, which it was relatively new. And he got funded by Kleiner Perkins, which is one of the backbone venture capitalists. It was the early days of venture capital, 1979, before I knew him. And then in the way of things, he kept building the business, kept going well. He took his company public in 1981. It was terrific. So it was all the things we think about today, you know, entrepreneurship, American dream, get rich by a Ferrari. I see you should reference the Times, Kleiner Perkins, from a couple days ago about where big fortunes are being made. They're on Sand Hill Road in Menlo Park now rather than in Wall Street. Kleiner Perkins is on Sand Hill Road. I was on Sand Hill Road last week, attempting to tap some of that fortune. But one day in 82 or 3, after I'd met Sweeney, whom I liked, and we got along, Medicare announced that they weren't quite sure why they were paying for this service, but what they did know was it wasn't a hospital, it wasn't a nursing home, it wasn't a home health agency, it wasn't a wheelchair or oxygen or durable medical equipment, all things they knew and recognized and knew how to pay for. So they weren't quite sure what to do. So Sweeney's stock went from 25 or 6 on the day that Medicare made this statement to 6 in about 3 days. And I ended up helping him, what turned out to be a couple of year thing, negotiating with Medicare. Is legal fiction still a turn of phrase? I love legal fiction. It was, I loved encountering it when I was here. And it put me in good stead because I talked what was then HCFA into a legal fiction, that this whole service and the provision of the amino acid, blah, 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 was really an artificial gut and therefore was a prosthetic device. And they knew what a prosthetic device was. It was like a wheelchair. It was okay. They got it. They could pay for it. So then it was just a question of negotiating the price, and you know, at that point we spent a little more, but it worked out okay. The irony of all this is, of course, that that home infusion business, which to this day is a really good way of providing care for a certain group of patients, became pretty seamy. So I actually became one of the great leading experts on fraud and abuse and payments to doctors. My client happily didn't want to do it, but every competitor seemed like it was doing it. And ultimately, on behalf of my client, I helped write the Stark bill and get it in place just because we wanted to put those guys out of business. But it was a wonderful experience. And I came to see a whole other tribe, the entrepreneur, the venture capitalist, the Southern California person who makes money, and sales guys. I really came to like sales guys. And I learned about sales guys. I used to go out with guys. They'd say, come on, let me take you out to see this doc and sort of you can see what we're up against in this fraud and abuse thing. And they were great. And it turns out, of course, it's a tribe. It's a profession. It's a flawed profession in many ways. But so here I now have had, this kind of arc. By 1985, I actually knew a lot about business. I knew about corporate development. I knew about private finance. I knew about public finance. I knew none of these things. I did not take a single course in corporation law, SEC, corporate tax. I knew nothing about business when I graduated. And I knew nothing about business for maybe 8 or 9 years after that because I was just doing public policy stuff. But the world, at least of healthcare, was so overlapping and so intertwined that, the other new thing that came up for me, by and large, was biotechnology, again, coming online in a significant way in the 80s. So Amgen came in as a client, and Amgen was a year or two away from launching what would be the second product in biotechnology, which was erythropoietin. They had been working for years. They'd raised about $300 million. They'd spent it on a bunch of stuff, but in general, EPO was going to be their big product, and had one other product coming behind that looked like it might succeed. To finance their company in the many ways in which they financed it, they chose as one tool to license out the rights to EPO. So they had licensed all the ex-US rights, they had licensed all the US rights, except for a core indication, which was for use in dialysis, to replace EPO that was gone and made patients somewhat anemic and made them more feel bad. And so you could replace the missing EPO in dialysis patients and they would feel better, hopefully function better. But they had one customer, federal government, Medicare, end-stage renal disease program. And this is the nightmare of all time for an entrepreneurial company. Not only are you going to be regulated by the government, it's your only customer. So I and others were hired, and we went through the following exercise. We said, look, you know, you got us again. Medicare, bless their hearts, you know, they wanted to do the right thing. They wanted their beneficiaries. They had concluded that this would be good for their beneficiaries. So it's just a question of price. So we said, look, they've raised $300 million. They raised $6 million in 1980 and 81 when they had a business plan. They raised blah, blah. And each time they raised it, there was this amount of risk. I mean, we could try and calculate it. And so by the time you get to the $300 million, you know, you can say how much risk a person might have felt putting in the money at that stage, buying the first stock in the first public offering, buying stock yesterday, whatever. So we say, here's how much we think we're going to sell. Here's what we know, because we know how many patients you have. We know what we think the dose is going to be. And here's how long it'll take to get increasingly used. Here's how many people will die. How many so it was a very interesting kind of exercise. So we said, you have to set the price at X per unit, given all these assumptions, in order to give a return on the investment which is appropriate to the investor at each of those different times. It was a very interesting model. And I can't remember, it's probably an internal rate of return of 30% or something like that. So 30%, I mean, that's just, you know. I remember sitting with Chuck Booth, who was in charge of reimbursement for Medicare, and I said, well, Chuck, let me ask you something. You're a good guy. You're trying to provide for your family. You'll get a pension from Medicare. You have some savings. How much of your savings would you have given to George Rathman in 1980 for his business plan? None, right? Because you would have figured you're just going to throw it away. You wouldn't have any money. Amgen's about a year away from FDA approval, so we think it's going to be approved. But how much stock in Amgen would you buy today if you could? He says, I don't know. I'm not sure I really want to buy any. I really got more kind of T-bills and stuff. I said, right. So you have a risk-free investment, X percent, whatever it was at the time. It was actually not too bad in those days, as you may remember, a lot of inflation. So think about all the guys who did this. So here's the thing. We have to make them feel good about taking the risk. And if they don't feel good about it, then nobody else is going to feel good about taking the risk. This is like a pure play in industrial policy. We can have investment in this product by the federal government that rewards to some reasonable degree, or that's going to be that. This is the second biotech product. So they went for it. And it was actually, the inspector general, it was a very complex exercise, but they bought it. It was new, they got it, they wanted the beneficiaries to have it, they wanted to have a price that would allow the company and therefore the industry to flourish. They totally got it. In fact, Pete Stark held instant hearings critical of the price as soon as the drug was launched, and they stood up to it because they felt like what they'd done was right. So off we went. So the team that had worked on it, which included a whole bunch of, me and lawyers at Hogan and other consultants and stuff, we're pretty good. We got about $6,000 a year, I think, as it then was, although I may be misremembering that. As I say, it was kind of an outrage. So we all got a pretty big laugh when another outfit showed up and said, well, we've got a drug, biotechnology drug, and we want to charge $250,000 a year. This is, same time, 1990. So You get a little cynical about clients, and we weren't cynical about this client, but we were laughing pretty hard at this notion of $250,000. But I met the guy, the CEO, and I, in his case was as follows. Look, unlike most drugs, we know this drug's going to work. If the patients have the disease, Gaucher disease, and we give them the medicine, which is a protein replacement for an essential missing protein that they have got because they have a single gene missing, they'll live, and they'll live normally. We don't give it to them, they'll die. It's a little oversimplified, but because there are a few patients who have cognitive issues. But in general, if we give it to them, it works, it's safe, it's great, they can take it for life at $250,000 a year, and if we don't, they'll die. But there's only about 5,000 of them in the world, the best we can tell. So by the time we've done the tens of millions in research and clinical development and built a $150 million plant, yada, 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 and, you know, we need $250,000 to make it worthwhile. And by the way, we're the only ones who even thought about doing this. Everybody knows the technology works, but nobody wants to industrialize it, because why would you? You have to ask $250,000. So I kind of said, all right, you know, I got into it. We did the same analysis, ran the numbers just like I described with Antigen, and $250,000 was actually a pretty reasonable number in terms of that kind of return on investment. And it turns out, you know, even in England, where we went through this discussion, they were okay with this because they knew the medicine would work. It wasn't like what we've all become inured to in some extent is, you know, $100,000 medicines that give you a couple of months benefit, you know, if you're one of the 30% of the patients who respond to it, or a couple of bucks a day for medicines that have a modest effect in millions and millions of people, 30% of whom has no effect. So in a way, we talked them into it. And the other thing we said was, look, we're going to give it to everybody, whether they can pay or not, all over the world, which in fact turned out to be the case. So it was also, we didn't make this as the central argument, but it was a kind of a social policy thing. Rich patients in rich countries inevitably going to be subsidizing with this price poor patients in poor countries. Not a bad model. To some extent, that's how America pharma prices also need to be looked at, because to some degree we are subsidizing a lot of medicine and a lot of the rest of the world. But that's a different conversation. So I came to like the company. As you can tell, I was no longer a lawyer. My partners at Hogan probably thought I hadn't been a lawyer forever and ever. I love strategic stuff. I love the kinds of things we're talking about. I love this intersection of business and private stuff. I love new things. So I went to Genzyme, where I stayed for 12 years, having represented for 8. The arc of that company, now bought by Sanofi, as some of you may know, was to go from a startup in 81 to a $20 billion acquisition by Sanofi, having tripped up, made some mistakes as a growing company. You know, 3 employees to 12,000. Fantastic run. And so I could go on and on forever, but I'm not going to stop. I would like a little time for questions just in case. But I do want to make a couple of points. And this is more for the students. You know, one thing is, it's okay, it's a proud thing to be a member of a tribe, to be an apprentice, to be a young trainee and a mid-level professional and a senior-level professional and a wise sage and then kind of a duffer, you know, whatever the arc of professions is. But you gotta understand the other tribes. I mean, most of my work has been trying to make things move, workflow, move horizontally across these vertically organized tribes, most of whom don't like the others and don't work very well together. And it's often because people just don't understand. There's also kind of this hierarchy of professions which trips things up. So, you know, the scientists look down, the doctors, the doctors look down on the lawyers. The lawyers all think business school is a joke. And the business school guys all think that sales guys are a joke. Engineers are kind of neutral, you know. They're certainly not scientists, my God, but they're not sales guys. And so they're useful people. It's good to have them here somewhere. But you can't get wrapped up in that. You have to understand the other tribe, you know, especially if you're going to be effective getting things done. You know, so I felt sometimes when I was practicing in Washington, you know, that my client would be speaking Chinese and the government guys were speaking French and, you know, fascinating. I was like a UN translator, you know. I sort of would get the Chinese not speaking to the thing. And a lot of it was just trying to say to people on either side, look, here's the problem that they're dealing with. It's a real problem. So you say to your client, the government has a real problem they have to deal with. You have to understand that problem. You have to understand where they're coming from to get yourself in their frame of mind. You have to agree and then see if you can work something out. And I think, you know, that's just an essential part of the deal. I'm in a project right now in which the lawyers are being just tremendously difficult. Fortunately, not the companies that I'm associated with, a different thing. You know, their client, which is the business unit of this big company, really enthusiastically wants to get something done with another company. And the lawyers are being pains in the ass, and it's because they don't quite get it. You know, they are fixed on what lawyers really know well, which is indemnification. You know, and what if 10 years from now the following happens? And it's an odd and frustrating thing to see, and I've seen it 100% of the time, it seems like, in deals I've done. The lawyers didn't get it. They didn't kind of understand even as well as they should what their clients were trying to accomplish. They didn't understand how to help the client get what the client wants while, you know, keeping them out of trouble. So ignore the hierarchy of professions if you can. Try to be embracing of salespeople. They are good people. Even if they're your clients. The other thing that I want to say is life is long, and this is again for the students. If you try this and you don't like it, you try that and you don't like it, you try this and it was a terrible mistake and you got to recover from it, and by the time you're under your feet and you've hit your stride, you're, you know, in your late 30s or even your mid 40s or whatever, it's okay. Most of it's going to work way beyond that. You're going to work in our 60s, or who knows, maybe 70s, the new 60, and the new retirement age will be 75. I mean, nobody knows, really. So, you know, if you hit stride at 40, you got 25 or 30 years to go, right? So you can take risk in your career. And one of the great things about healthcare is you can get going and stuff, and all the whole world can change, and stuff appears which nobody knew about today, which requires you to, you know, master something brand new, and that's okay, because if it takes you 5 years to master it, still got 20 years to be an expert, right? So, I'm only making this point a little bit because Warren and I talked about it last night, and because I give my kids this speech more or less perpetually. I mean, I went up to Genzyme, moved to Boston, started really a fundamentally new career, loved that period. The next 12 years, learned an enormous amount. But I arrived in Boston, I was 50 years old. You know, I started Genzyme, I was 50 years old. Now, I am working just as hard. I am learning about, you know, all kinds of stuff I didn't know much about. Chemical engineering, polymers, knew a little bit about polymers. You know, vascular biology, the Australian public markets, you know, the world of interventional radiology and its kind of, you know, shifting place in the, between interventional cardiology and vascular, this and that. Aortic aneurysm repair, just all this stuff I didn't know anything about. I'm taking notes. I take notes furiously all day long. I keep notebook after notebook. And I'm like a perpetual student. You know, I'm raising money and learning how little I actually knew about venture capital, notwithstanding that I thought I knew a lot about it. There's nothing like sitting on the other side. And I'm having a great time. I'm 64 years old. So, you know, I was laughing with John before. One of the messages here is you can take 50 years to kind of figure out what you want to do. So That may or may not be true. That said, my father, who worked his whole career for the telephone company in a relatively modest job, retired when he was 55 on a very small pension from the telephone company. He lived as happily and busily as a person could for the next 31 years. So, you know, there are a lot of paths. The real trick is, you know, finding one that works for you. But I love healthcare because it's got so many of those paths. You know, almost anything you want to do, anything you're good at, you can probably figure out a way to do it in healthcare. So that's a pitch, but for what, I don't know, other than I'm glad you're here. And,